It's time to clip your last good piece and dig in, because the runout starts now.
So, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Yeah.
Aside from my reputation as like being just a well-rounded, amazing rock climber, do you know what else I'm known for in the climbing world?
Breaking that big hold off of, what was it, Bone Machine maybe or something like that? Didn't you break some giant hold off of
a Barry, I ruined a five-star classic
dumpster barbecue or some shit?
Which one was it? Bone Machine.
It was Bone Machine.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's that. Anyway, what else are you known for besides that?
I was going to say breaking holds off roots. And often on the send.
I got it.
Yeah. Yeah, I broke another jug on a send burn too. It fortunately, it didn't ruin the root like I did on Bone Machine, but I've done that a couple times now where I've been sending a root. I'm like either going to do it or above the crux or something and just break hold and just fall and ruin my red
point. Much fucking power ripping through your body that you just start tearing holds off. You and Wes Schweitzer are going to be well known for fucking tearing holds off of roots.
Yeah,
my friend Wes Schweitzer, which is a whole nother story.
I know. He fixed your shoulder up, didn't he?
He fixed my shoulder up. That's a callback to last episode, the NFL, the New York Jet, who after our interview got onto a 35-minute FaceTime call with me, and he fixed my shoulder. Like, no joke. Like, he gave me two little exercises to do and watched me do them and made me take my shirt off, and he took his shirt off, and so there was, like, the skinny, leathery bag of bones and the fucking, you know, NFL linebacker, like, watching each other do exercises. And he fixed my shoulder. Like, no joke, no lie. One stretch, one exercise, and I'm good to go.
That's amazing. So,
anyhow, but that interrupted
our thing.
That's
how they keep those players, you know, going week after week after.
I know, but he seems to be like coming from he was kind of giving me secret knowledge. I felt like, and he's really into it. I feel like maybe that's his new angle. He might be a trainer or something because he's really into it. Anyway, check out that last interview, last episode for a really. I mean, didn't we both feel great after that interview?
I love that interview.
Yeah, and I felt great about climbing. Yeah. And yeah. I was like, he is right. Climbing is amazing again. So it pumped a little bit of soul back into our crustiness after listening to how psyched he was. So anyhow, well, you're breaking holds. Back to that. Or go ahead.
Yeah, you just ruined my transition into our topic today. But
oh, shit.
It's okay.
All right, start over.
No, we'll leave that all in. I was going to try to, you know, gracefully make a segue into this topic that came up on our Instagram channel last week. And it is that this famous boulder problem in Colorado, John Gill Boulder, called Mental Standard on the mental block, really classic, iconic boulder, basically. Like, I think he first did it in 1968. So 70-year-old problem or something like that. One of the holds broke, and climbers in this area put up the question of whether the hold should be glued back onto the boulder or not. So I thought we could talk about that.
Yeah, I think the post was interesting and the comments were interesting. And there's three or four different issues that it brings up that are like much larger than just this post. So
I was thinking back, aside from my own history of just like breaking holds, I was recalling an incident on, also in Rifle, of course, on the Anti-Fill, a famous route out there. And there's this hold on that route that broke off. And literally before anyone could even like debate about whether to glue it back on the wall, Eric Vining threw the hold into the river. So it wasn't even an option. Which is too bad because the head wall is much worse than it was. I mean, there's just like one move that used to be really, really cool. And now it's like an annoying, harder move, basically, without this hold. So, you know, I can see the arguments for and against gluing holds. And I'm kind of don't really have a strong like axiom about it one way or the other. Like, I think it's kind of conditional and dependent on situations, but it is interesting to me that there's so many people who really do believe one or the other to be like the only way forward.
Mm-hmm. It's also one of these things, which is one of the issues, is that, you know, when you leak it into the public sphere, which, you know, this Instagram post did, I think there's a lot of people, and actually probably the majority of the climbing community, that are appalled that gluing goes on at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the irony of it is if these people climb on limestone sport climbing with any frequency, then they have happily used glued on or glue reinforced holds, not glued on, but glue reinforced holds.
Yeah.
And so, cause limestone is just not, it's actually not the best rock in the world, generally speaking. And so anyhow, but it's just always this thing of like there's this whole segment that are appalled, but you know, it's just like the dirty little secret that shit gets reinforced with glue on limestone climbs.
Yeah.
And if it's done well, you never know.
Yeah, exactly. You can be really artistic about it. There's,
yeah.
And it's more like the dolomitic style limestone that's kind of blocky and kind of fractures into squares mm-hmm. and rectangles and stuff. And mm-hmm. that's kind of easy to, you know, add like a little bit of glue behind a flake or, you know, kind of along a seam to prevent something from coming off the wall. And the other thing that's interesting about glue is that it's actually stronger than the rock bond itself. If you get good contact between the hold and the you know, the greater wall, like it's never coming off, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Modern glues, the same stuff that essentially you're putting glue and bolts in,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's definitely bomber.
So this is kind of interesting. So just so people, if they haven't seen this post, I'm just going to describe what it looks like. So it's this kind of graphic that says mental standard has broken ! And it's a picture of someone holding the hold that broke, which is shaped like a heart or maybe the African continent. I'm not sure.
a little cubist version of it, kind of.
Yeah. And then you see the boulder behind it with the imprint of where the shape was and like kind of a large jagged side pole that's been left in the wake of this hold being broken off. So kind of what was normally just like this down pulling hold might turn into this big juggy kind of side pole thing. So, you know, I'm no expert on this, but if I had to guess, I would say it's certainly possible to glue the hold back onto the boulder based on kind of the geometry I'm looking at. And, you know, it looks just kind of like it would be a perfect fit. Like it wouldn't be like this awkward, you know, mess of just like a mosaic of like shards and holds that you kind of piece together onto the wall. It's just like this one perfect like hold that came off and you could kind of fit it right back onto the rock. And with, you know, proper gluing technique, you know, potentially make it so you almost wouldn't notice exactly what had happened.
It does seem to be a perfect candidate because it also appears that like the interface between the hold and what's the rock would be very smooth and almost puzzle pieced in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue. I mean, we talked about like not being strident on gluing or not gluing, and that can depend on like what happened to the hold. It shattered it, you know, or whatever. And this one, I mean, it's definitely a candidate like for a glue. And actually, doesn't it say that it had been glued or reinforced by glue?
I saw that you made a comment about that, but I wasn't sure I saw that. Hold on, let me just
read it. Yeah, it says in there, somebody said that, maybe even in the post, that it had previously been glued, actually.
Yeah, the starting hold on Mental Block had already been reinforced with glue by someone years ago. Sadly, okay. It was not enough to keep it in place.
So, but anyhow, yeah, so it's pretty, you know, I don't know. I think it looks like a candidate to be glued on, but that doesn't mean it should be glued on.
Yeah, so that's an interesting distinction because actually, so it had been reinforced, which I assume means like some, and you can kind of see actually the line outline of glue along the bottom left edge of the hold.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like someone probably just smeared, you know, a patina of glue along a little crack along the left edge of the hold.
Mm-hmm.
So now that it's fully off the wall, you could, you know, glue it on there and it would not come off. Like it just wouldn't. So I guess the question speaks to a couple different issues, ethical and just also maybe historical. Like one thing I think you could consider is the historical value of this problem. And, you know, is it an homage to someone like John Gill to kind of keep the hold as it was, to kind of preserve that history? Is there any value in that aspect of it?
Well, I mean, we could ask John Gill. He's still kicking.
Someone did. And oh, really? Yeah, there's a Mountain Project thread and someone was like, what does John Gill think? Is he here? And then like the next comment was John Gill. And he's like, I don't follow the climbing world anymore and I don't really care.
But apparently he does.
Yeah.
Because so, he was there.
So. I imagine someone kind of maybe, tipped him off that this was happening. And so he came on. I'll just read his exact comments so that
cool. Yeah.
So that we.
Unless, of course, this isn't John Gill.
Right. It could. It's just, who knows?
You know, John Gill Climber 69. Someone masquerading as John Gill.
So he says, I've been out of the game too long. Didn't even know sandstone holds could be glued back on. Perhaps the Fort Collins climbers should have a big part in the decision. Just a thought. He's not really giving us a lot there, is he?
No, not at all.
I mean, he could come in, out and just say, no, don't glue it. Or, yeah, please glue it back. And then that would be the end of the discussion. People would just have to respect what it is that he says.
Yeah. Well, sort of intertwined in this issue is an issue that I am now super famous for, which is climbing on wet rock. Because the post implies that this happened because someone climbed on it while it was wet, which I lived in Fort Collins. And again, we didn't have this sense of this, you know, and just because we didn't doesn't mean it's not an important subject, but the idea of not climbing on it because it was wet just never came up, like, or mm-hmm. or not because it was wet, but because it had, like, let's say rained the day before or whatever. Like, I spent most of my climbing career not having any sense of that, and I continue to kind of, like, in my mind, like, it is sandstone, like it has the word sandstone in it, but it's not Indian Creek Red Rock sandstone or Red Rock Stand sandstone. It's Dakota sandstone. It's really hard.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I was very skeptical of this whole, like, it happened because it clearly has a fracture in it. Like it, and like I said, there was some other issues with it being maybe loose before. So the little scold about the wet sandstone thing kind of made me roll my eyes as usual. But
it's such a dubious claim. Like
it's a very dubious claim in that particular rock.
I mean, it's possible that the hold broke because it had rained the day before. It's also possible that the hold had been fractured and was on its way to breaking. And after 70 years of
fat boys. Oh, man. To hear the rest of this oh-so-controversial story, go to patreon.com/runoutpodcast and become a rope gun today. Find out where we stand on the question of glue or not the glue and our thoughts on punishing the perp. I'll give you a hint.
Shame. 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 Shame.
That's patreon.com/runoutpodcast to support the show and get the total spray.
Jesse Grouper is a mechanical engineer, a sport climber who's flash 514C, and he's on Team USA headed to Paris 2024 for the Olympic Games. Well, Jesse, you are about, 2 months away from heading to Paris? I'm not sure when you're going over there, but how are you feeling about...
I'd say three.
3 months? Okay. Is it in August?
Give me a little time. Yeah, it'll be in August. End of July, we'll head out.
Cool. So give us the current state of the Olympic team standing. I know the full American team hasn't been finalized yet, but how are we looking 3 months out from the Olympics?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, I feel like the projections, like in Tokyo, for instance, was that we wouldn't even have a full roster. And now we're, you know, of course, we had a full roster in Tokyo. And Now going into Paris, we have almost a full team as well. Yeah, so it's me, Colin, Natalia, and then one other female for Boulder and Lead will be decided. And then on the speed side of things, we got Sam Watson, Piper Kelly, Emma Hunt, and then one other male will be decided for speed in the upcoming OQS. So yeah, pretty exciting.
You know, you qualified at the, was it the Pan Am? Like,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So how's your life changed since then? Was that like a big, did you notice a big change in your life? Like kind of from being officially on the Olympic team to not being on the Olympic team and merely crushing comps and doing well as a outdoor rock climber?
Yeah, I would definitely say there was like a outside pressure. I think people expecting to like meet like someone who's going to the Olympics, like I feel like there's a bar is raised. And I think that for me personally, like I'm still doing the same grind I was doing, you know, 2, 5, 10 years ago. But I feel like the level of what people expect from me maybe has changed. So I think it's been a lot about updating my expectations for what other people expect of me, to say it in a funny way. But I guess then also like there's been a little bit more on the media side of things, getting a couple more interviews, you know, being on the Runout podcast, you know, that would have never been possible.
Yeah, you finally
had that not happened.
Jesse.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
You either have to climb Mount Everest or qualify the Olympics. That's the only people we talk to.
There you go. Pretty exciting.
Honestly, it's our fault because we really should have had you on the show when you were flashing all those hard roots and rifle, because that's fully in our wheelhouse. And
oh, we can go there too.
I'm not sure how familiar our listeners are with who you are and some of the things that you've done in climbing, but it's pretty amazing some of the flashes you've done. I'm not sure how many other Americans have flashed as hard as 14C. Maybe you know the history there.
I actually still don't, which is kind of funny. I think that there has been at least one other, but Daniel Woods flashed Pure Imagination is the only other one that I know of off the top of my head. But I'm sure there are other crushers in America that maybe I just haven't heard of. We'll see.
And Live in Astro is the 14C you flash. Have you done others, or was that the hardest one?
Yeah, Live in Astro was the first, and then I also flashed Pure Imagination this past November.
Nice. Cool. And so tell us just about your, like, that kind of ability to climb, you know, really hard at that level. Is that born of, you know, competition, or is it outdoor experience? How did you get to that level?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll share a story about where I feel like this drive sort of started. So I wouldn't say that I've always been naturally like talented at this kind of style, but I do think it's something that I've always been drawn to. And the first time it really became apparent to me was climbing in the New River Gorge. I was trying this climb called Dial 911, and I really wanted to give it a good like on-site go. And the New River Gorge is iconic just for, you know, many hard moves, especially like as a kid. It's challenging because there are a lot of big reaches between smaller holds, and the rock is just really hard to read in general. So I would be sort of climbing into a crux, not really knowing how the crux would go because it was an on-site go, and then getting a little bit pumped and feeling like I might fall, and then I would just like down climb the part of the crux that I had just done. And I must have done that on every single hard move like 3 or 4 times. And I was like, yeah, redlining for so long. And for every single crux that I got through, I felt like it was more and more important for me to stay on for longer. And it made every single crux feel that much more important to get past and get through. And I could tell sort of like the impatience, but also like the focus of like my like mentor at the time, like Jeff Jenkins, who would like come with us on like different climbing trips. And I, you know, felt this sort of pressure to send this climb from myself, and then also like just to show that I could. It eventually took 1 hour and 20 minutes for me to kind of get to the top. And it was like this constant like up and down and doing all of this like resting and back and forth. And I eventually got down, and he made a joke saying like, I would have been so frustrated with you if you had fallen at the end or something like that. But it probably took like 30 minutes to do like that end, you know, one clip, just because I really wanted to finish it out. And I think that, yeah, that style of just like being at my limit and then trying to kind of calm myself down and do like a little bit more has always been like appealing for me for one reason or another. And I think that I kind of have carried that out on climbs like Live in Astro or Pure Imagination, where it's just a lot of repeated crux over a period of time with some rests. And I think like being able to really read climbs fast is important, of course, for competition. But I also think it's quite an exciting style for me to just be able to continually be in the zone, get it back, and then like try to push a little bit further.
You know, looking at your climbing career, as it were, and reading some stuff about you, not only outdoor climbing, but indoor climbing, you know, there, it seems like, I don't know how to actually phrase this, so you can correct me if I get sort of the phrasing wrong, but you've been a little bit like foot in two worlds at the very least, like now with work and academically too before that, and kind of wondering whether or not you were, you know, cut out or going to keep doing these competitions and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your ambivalence at times and then kind of restarting and re-getting back into it? Do you know what I'm talking about? There's sort of a little bit of a pattern of like, well, I could do this, but I could also, you know, not kind of a thing.
And yet, yeah, here you for are, sure. Like,
I mean, I think it's always for the Olympics.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's always been a bit of back and forth for me. I think that, you know, to be honest, I think it like looks different in my path versus like other people who are like trying to go to the Olympics. But I think that that dream has like sort of always been there. It's just been maybe a little bit more challenging to realize it, not being like paid to climb initially or like having kind of that opportunity. I also think that for me, I, you know, always wanted to like go to college. It was something that I was excited for. And then I was like, well, like I really want to give like at least 1 year to fully committing to the circuit. And maybe that'll lead to the Olympic pathway someday. But I really just like have always loved climbing. And I really want that to be something that I focus on for at least a year. But then coming back, I was like, well, I had also spent all this time and investment into going to college, and I want to see if that is exciting and an awesome path for me to follow as well. So I think that's where like sort of the back and forth came from. But throughout that whole time, like I never doubted that I would be climbing for like my whole life, and that competition was an essential like part of that. I just didn't know like what level I could reach by doing both at the same time. And of course, ultimately, it was a decision between, well, I'm hopefully a little bit younger right now, and this opportunity won't be there forever. So why don't I try to take advantage of it?
But you have managed to keep working part time, it sounds like, in mechanical engineering.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm working in a robotics lab right now, working part time, and it has been a fun balance, I would say. I feel like not thinking about climbing 24/7. Helps me kind of like de-stress a little bit. And I think it's also quite fun to have other problems to think about and yeah, challenges to face that are outside of climbing. And hopefully like the work that I'm doing will help others like in the future. And I think that that makes life feel like a little bit more meaningful as well.
One of these things that sort of features in a few places that I read about you was this competition where you and a bunch of other people didn't get off the ground. And that was sort of, it seems like that was early in this current arc, and that was like where you started, and it's kind of fascinating to see that, and then now you're qualified for the Olympics. So can you kind of like fill that in just a little bit?
Yeah, so basically I was like working full-time for 2.5 years and then suddenly made like the US team for like both bouldering and lead. I had never done like a bouldering World Cup. I had done several lead ones by that point, and I had no conception of like what doing a bouldering World Cup would be like. And going out to Merrigan, which was my first bouldering World Cup, which was about 2 years ago to the date, I got utterly destroyed. It felt like one of the most like embarrassing rounds of competition that I've ever had. I didn't get off the ground on almost any of the climbs. I didn't get off the ground on any of the climbs there. Got a score of 0 and had to walk away from that being like, yeah, but like the dream still lives that like one day, like maybe I'll still be an Olympian, or like that I would be able to, you know, push my limits in the sport. So yeah, it is kind of a crazy turn of events, but I think it also taught me a lot. Yeah, made me recognize quite quickly that if I wanted to do what I wanted to do, I would have to put in the work and do it fast.
I just wanted to return to one thing that we were talking about before about the on-site, you know, mentality and temperament and stuff. I often find that there's like these two binary personalities in sport climbing at a high level. Like people either call themselves on-site climbers or red point climbers. And like you're a red point climber often by default because you're bad at on-site climbing. So you have nothing left to do but be a red point climber. But I also find that people who kind of identify as on-site climbers tend to not like red pointing because there's often like added stress or anxiety that goes along with that process of just like plugging away at one route over and over until you do it. Or how do you define yourself in that framework? And do you also enjoy the red point process?
Yeah, I think that I like all aspects of the sport. And I guess I also would like challenge that for other people as well. Like, I think that putting yourself in one camp is probably not the best way to improve in climbing as a whole. Like, even if you're, you know, trying to give red point goes on, say, a 13A, like, I think that it's within your wheelhouse to try, like, to onsite a 12A. And maybe, like, of course, those levels are going to be different, but I think that they both push you to understanding climbing to a new level. For me, I think maybe flashing is, like, a happy medium where I think that it's a little bit less stressful than onsiting, but also still has a lot of the fun of still encountering the unknown and being uncertain, but having to react to that and being uncomfortable and having to react to that as well. So I think that is quite an exciting part about flashing to me. I also think that I grew up like, I don't know, maybe I'm like a newer generation where like I grew up like watching so many videos of like the pros like climbing and sending climbs that I always wanted to try. And as soon as you watch a video like that, it's like, okay, you're done. Like you can't onsite it anymore. So maybe like onsiting will be a thing that I will be able to do more as I get to go to like new areas and new places that haven't had as many videos, or maybe I just haven't happened to have seen those videos. But yeah, I guess I definitely enjoyed being a climbing nerd like as a kid and watching those videos. So it makes the whole process of onsiting like that much harder.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I remember hearing a little scuttlebutt here in at our local crag about some of your flashes in rifle employing laser pointing technology. Is that correct? And do you get into any kind of like of these, like, as a, you know, I guess as a fellow climbing nerd, is there some kind of ethical transgression with using laser pointers to on your flash ascent?
Whoa. You know, that's funny. I didn't even remember that happened. I think it was one route and someone at the base of a crag just happened to have a laser pointer. Yeah, it's only happened once.
Wasn't like you brought out a team of beta junkies laser pointers to help you up.
Exactly.
There.
It was me.
For
actually.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Grab this hold exactly like this in this position with this thumb on the laser right now. Yeah. That's definitely not a planned thing by any means. If someone happens to have a laser pointer, I feel like ethically, like that's okay by my standards. It's the same as like pointing out holds on a video or similar. But yeah, I don't, I guess personally, like I prefer to, yeah, see a rock ahead of me and yeah, maybe hear someone calling if there's someone who has a beta, but yeah, no laser pointer needed.
That was actually me with the laser pointer. There's been no real like anything to kind of talk about in rifle for a while, so I thought I'd create a problem.
nice. An ethical dilemma.
An ethical dilemma for us to chit chat about because I was tired of talking about conditions.
I do wonder though, like if you had someone, I guess just to push it, like I don't know, maybe if you had someone like in your ear constantly, like if someone was riding a balloon like right next to you, like I feel like there would be times when I would be like, okay, that is just not as cool as like actually like flashing it or onsighting it. Ethically, but
Jesse, if there was someone riding a balloon yelling out beta, that would be really cool, actually.
Like just next to you? Yeah. I don't
know. With a fan on the hold.
I mean, as long as they were,
as long as
they were in a balloon, it's fine.
Yeah, that's fair.
If you got one like of those Secret Service earbuds in your ear.
Yeah, I think outside. I don't know. I'm not on Instagram like that much, but I just saw that they had like a video with this guy backpacking with like a helium balloon on his backpack.
Oh yeah,
to like take off the weight or whatever.
Yeah,
and I don't know. Like I feel like imagining someone riding like a helium balloon right next to you while you're flashing or trying to on-site, it actually could make things harder too. Like I feel like I'd be pretty nervous. Like, is this guy going to hit me? What's going to happen?
Is this balloon going to pop?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
He's going to fall to his death.
So
I would want a balloon filled with my haters, just like rooting for me to fail. Cause it would, I think that would be more inspiring for me to put.
That's pretty good. Yeah. Okay, I think we're
coming up with some new ideas.
Yeah, it's like you're talking about, the on-site's kind of almost dead. You know, it's almost impossible with new media. So we have to find some new categories. So the hate site would be the one where people are just trying to make you fall, giving you bad beta, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, so, there's some more options here. We'll talk about it later. Can I ask you to go back to this this robotics thing and not just what you do professionally, but also the level of, I would imagine, the level of sort of academic intensity that got you to this level. And again, one of the things about, I think, you know, even with more modern versions of like Team USA, it's always been noted how, you know, American climbers don't have these giant networks of support that, you know, let's say the Austrians have, or Japanese climbers, you know, these like sports programs that keep them fed and training all the time. You've managed to do it, you know, keeping all these other things alive. So tell me a little bit about that part of pursuing this degree that was obviously very intense, and then doing some work that's also, you know, takes a lot of time and energy. How do you do that? How do you kind of manage to do both?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, like, having both always made me better at both, is what I said in college. And I think even now, I think having dedicated times where I would be in school and dedicated times where I'd be training, and if I was running over with school, like, that would mean less time for training, or vice versa. School kind of always came first, but, you know, I would also find creative ways of making it work, like doing homework in between sets at the gym, or you know, like trying to remember different molecules for bio, or staying on the wall and like thinking about those to myself while doing a circuit or something like that. But ultimately, like, I think that kind of efficiency that I built with school and with work combined with climbing has made me better at going to the gym and getting in what I need to. I think it's, yeah, kind of set me up to do well on this front. And I think that, yeah, I feel grateful to have found that balance. I think it is quite hard. And I think that, of course, it takes sacrifices. Like, maybe I didn't have as much of a social life in college as other people who I knew, but I was quite happy in the gym and had other friends who were, of course, there. And it just like looked different than maybe the typical college experience. But yeah, I mean, I think that overall, I think it made me better in both. Or at least I hope so.
There's a long tradition of lack of social life in climbing that came a lot long before that. Can you talk a little bit about your work? I've been hinting at it. You mentioned a little bit before, and it sounds just fascinating and engaging, and like you said, doing good in the world. So describe what it is you do.
Yeah, so I work in a lab at a university called the Biodesign Lab. And essentially, it kind of runs like an incubator, where it has a lot of different projects that are set up throughout the lab with various like grad students and research fellows and postdocs on each project. And I've worked on like an array of projects, and I think that's why it's like kind of exciting for me to stay in the lab for so long. I've worked on robotic glove projects to help stroke patients, ankle projects for stroke patients, shoulder projects for stroke patients, and also like engineering education tools to teach people about soft robotics. The whole lab kind of runs off of this idea that like soft robotics is the future. So essentially, like, instead of using metallic structures to interface with like people's bodies, what if we like use textiles or fabrics and squishy things as opposed to metals? And if we were able to move them instead of metallic structures, wouldn't that be more comfortable and fitting for a human? So yeah, it's kind of an exciting space, and it's definitely been fascinating to me to both get to work with people on the ground level, and then also just more remotely today work on projects that, you know, will ultimately help others achieve like performance goals either at work or in like their daily lives. And I think that for me, like, human performance has like always been a center of my life. both with climbing, and it's been fun to be able to integrate that with work as well.
We have some shared background here because I started also at Tufts as a freshman in mechanical engineering. And
oh, that's crazy.
But then
and you hated it?
I hated it, and I switched to something else. I went to the liberal arts. But yeah.
Did you stay at Tufts?
Yeah, I stayed at Tufts and graduated in 2003. Just right around when you graduated, a few years before.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, that's super cool.
I'm curious to know just like what the culture is of climbing at the university now, because when I was there, it was very kind of nascent and there weren't a ton of climbers. But do you feel like it's the climbing community has just grown and expanded as gyms and stuff have come to Boston?
Yeah, honestly, it was pretty insane to me. You know, in high school and middle school, I always felt kind of like an outsider, I guess, because I was doing a sport that wasn't, you know, the typical ball sports that you would see in school. And then coming to university, I think that was kind of mind blowing. I think that we had a team of almost like 80 to 100 people who would, you know, have a wide range of like desire to climb consistently. But still, like, they were on the team, they would come to events, they would go to competitions here or there. And I think that, yeah, having that community that my school friends and climbing friends could sort of be the same was like, yeah, mind blowing, honestly. And I think that at the time, like, Tufts had like one of the biggest teams. I don't know where it's at right now. It's crazy to think that I'm almost like 5 years out of college. But yeah, it's been, I think, a really positive like social experience as far as like being able to integrate school and climbing at the same time.
That's super cool to hear. So let's talk a little bit more about the Olympics. One question I had was just around your qualifying. At the time, Sean Bailey posted like this kind of lament about having to compete against people who, you know, he might have competing for spots on the team, basically. I'm not sure if you saw that or what your two cents was on that. I didn't really understand precisely what he was upset about, other than he didn't like the way the competition was run. But do you feel like there's any room for improvement in terms of just how people, you know, get onto the Olympic team?
Yeah, I mean, for starters, like, climbing is a relatively new sport to the Olympics, very new to the Olympics. It's only the second time that it ever will be in the Games. And I think with that, we have fewer quota spots per country because it's just not that big of an event yet. So we have two quota spots per country. And I think that off the bat, like, we're a team of about five who compete internationally. And I think that these become like some of your closest friends and some of, you know, your most trusted like training partners. And it's hard because like you're all trying to do the best you can and you want the best for each other because you're constantly seeing the work that everyone's putting in. And I think that I'm not exactly sure of which post that was, but I think that, you know, by the time Pan Ams came around and we had been competing with each other for years and years and years, it just is hard to want something so bad for yourself that you know will block someone else from entering that door with you. And I think that ultimately all competitions for me are about focusing on yourself. Of course, like having, you know, if a friend needs something, like being there for them, but just honing in on like what you hope to achieve and then showing up and then kind of after the fact coming back to this like training and team environment more so. I think overall is like what happened in Pan Ams. And I think even to this day, you know, like I think that I'm just like rooting for Sean and Zach and like, you know, many of the other team members. And it's like really incredible for me to like be watching like what they're doing. And honestly, sometimes I'm like a little bit jealous and or like envious of like, oh man, like I wish I could like go outside and like go hang with them too. But I think ultimately, I'm of course really psyched to like be on this path and feel really fortunate to have landed this way. But you know, as far as like skill wise, like I think any of them could have been in similar shoes and would be as deserving, honestly. So yeah, I think that's like always a challenging one, but one that I'm continuing to, you know, work on. And I think I'll just also say, like, in 2019 was my first time like competing on the circuit like internationally, and I just felt like the team vibes were how to put it, play like they just weren't there as much. Like I think that we weren't a unit, we weren't showing up at the same times, we weren't training together, And I think that the team has really developed to the point where we are doing things in unison. We're staying at the same places. We're, you know, having team dinners. We're training at the same times. And I think that that development and growth is like really meaningful to me to see on the team as a whole. And it's, yeah, really, really awesome as well. And I think we'll push the sport in America that much further.
I mean, it's really the nature, obviously, of sports, right? Is that you're competing to win. One of the things that certain rock climbers reject about competition climbing is exactly that, the competition part of it, even though there's always been this, like, you know, underlying competition within climbing. But it's just fascinating to kind of confront that in a sense. Like, here's the sport. We love, you know, being at the crag with our buddies and climbing. And it's always, that's always the addendum on every post about climbing outside, is how much it was, how great it was to be there with your friends. But then you also are put in these positions where, you know, you're trying to win, trying to be the best and be better than the person, you know, climbing next to you. So I don't know. It feels like it's just that it's still working out. It's kind of an uneasy match between the outdoor culture and the competition culture. I don't know if you have any comment on that.
I think for me, like, competitions are always about pushing myself. Mm-hmm. And I think the times when I do my worst, honestly, are the times when I think too much about the competition and where I want to place as opposed to where I want to climb or how I want to climb. I think that there are a lot of like parallels, as you mentioned, like with outdoor climbing as well, whether it's like going for an FA or just being trying the same climb with your friends and being the first one to sort of do it. I think that those are all similar challenges, but at the heart of it, like, I think that we all love climbing for similar reasons. We love being able to go from like this feeling that this climb or this obstacle is like impossible and then making it feel more possible, whether that be like overcoming like a new grade level or overcoming like a specific climb, or in a competition, just getting a little bit further than you thought was possible in the moment or before. So I think that's like, you know, where my love of the sport at least comes from. And I think like keeping it sort of that wholesome piece is something that I hope can be felt, and like that ethos is like continued throughout, like, you know, the future of the sport. Like, I always talk about like the ethos of like, you know, the preview time in a competition where, you know, you're literally like giving your competitors competitive advantages by sharing information about a climb that you think is the best way to do it. But ultimately, like, I think that that's like the best way to represent what would happen like on rock as well, and where the like the history of the sport comes from. Is like, we want everyone to be able to have their best chance at doing whatever climb is in front of us. And I think when that piece of the sport is represented the best, it's when I feel most at home. And it's when I feel like the sport will have like a legacy that is different from any other like Olympic sport.
Looking at programs around the world and your competitors from other countries and therefore other cultures, do you think that attitude's prevalent? You know, the sort of teamwork at all costs kind of thing, more so than not?
Yeah, I think that it has been maintained, I would say, like in most like World Cups that I've like been in. I think the language barrier makes it challenging to to be able to say for sure. And I think that there, I'm not going to call any teams out. There probably are teams that are like less willing to share, but ultimately I would just say like that hurts them in the long run. Like we've seen it before where a certain team will kind of read by themselves and not share information, and then they'll all do the same move in the wrong way. And I don't know, like, I feel like that's like I don't necessarily believe in like karma, but like, it's like, oh man, like
it's known goal.
Yeah. It's kind of, yeah, for sure. So I think that, I think maybe one time, if you don't share information about a specific climb, it would advantage you. But I think in the long run, if you continue to have that process, it will be the most beneficial for your career and for the sport in the long run.
So you're, I think, maybe known for lead climbing more than bouldering. And have you been, like, how are you thinking about like those two genres? Because they're so different. Like, are you tailoring your training and preparation toward one or the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always been, or I consider myself like a boulder and lead climber. I think that I always do most sessions like 50-50. It's just that the modern like competition style maybe isn't as suiting of my skills in the sport as others might. And I think that, like, you know, when you look at me, it's like easy to compare to other people who are like, you know, the best boulders in the world, because, you know, you might also look at me and compare me to like the best lead climbers in the world. But I still feel like it's like been exciting to make big improvements in the bouldering side of things for myself and in competition. But overall, I think you're right. Like, I think that there's a lot more for me to learn in bouldering, specifically competition style, than there is necessarily for like lead climbing. I would say that I'm still trying to split it up 50-50, but I think the winter has been a little bit more focused on gaining some of those skills in bouldering that maybe I hadn't had before, and maybe just like improving bits and pieces, maybe being able to jump further, be a little bit more coordinated, all that good stuff. And then I think leading up to the games, I'm going to switch more into like full lead mode. And when I say full, of course, like the focus maybe being a little bit heavier on the lead side, but still honing in and making sure that those like bouldering skills are like up to snuff.
So that's interesting. Like, how do you prepare for, or how do you work on those bouldering skills? Like, does, I would imagine that requires working with like an experienced, you know, route setter, bouldering route setter at the IFSC level, who knows how to set problems that would challenge you? Or is this something that you're able to DIY just, you know, based on, you know, like going to the gym and, you know, jumping between different holds that have already been screwed into the wall for you?
Yeah. So like the analogy I'd make there is that bouldering for me has felt like learning a new language, and I need to kind of like understand the letters and then some vocabulary in order to start like forming my own sentences. All of that initial work, I would say, is definitely important to do with key setters like Josh and Io and Mike Pacino, who like work in the training center here in Salt Lake. And I think I've been putting in the work with them and with other setters around the country whenever I can to better understand that sort of vocabulary. But then once I go into a new gym or a new space, or like want to go to Europe and train by myself for a little bit or with other friends, then it's about trying to apply that vocabulary to like make my own sentences. And whether that be like coming up with new movement or just asking the right questions, I think has been a big opening of my mind, like in competitive bouldering, that I hadn't had before. And I think it's something that I'm continuing to apply while also like kind of learning new vocabulary by like working with those key players and key setters at the training center today as well.
You know, this is a pretty deep in the weeds climbing podcast, and I think climbing in general has been equally, you know, like excited about this whole Olympic thing that started in Tokyo. But we also like kind of, you know, we're just naturally like, oh yeah, we'll downplay a little bit. It's just another competition. I mean, some competitors, you know, almost need to do that to sort of overcome the hype. But, you know, the Olympics is a big ass deal outside of climbing, and you have this whole other world outside of climbing. You also, you know, obviously have a family, and so what was it? I mean, what's it been like to, you know, they're probably all like, oh yeah, we know Jesse's a climber. That's cool. Like, yeah, I climbed at a birthday party once. Yeah, it was fun. And then it's like suddenly you're actually an Olympic qualifier. Has that like blown some of your, you know, lab people's minds? And how has your family taken it? Because it's a big deal out there, you know, and it's a special thing.
Yeah, I think it's so funny because like, to me, of course, like the Olympics has always been like a dream. But for me, like I feel like I'm like still improving as a climber and still getting better. But I've always been the same climber that I am. And it's funny to have people externally be like, yeah, you're amazing at this. Like, I had no idea. And it's like, well, like, you know, like I won a World Cup 2 years ago, or like I won nationals like 5 years ago or whatever. And I feel like it is funny. Like, this is like the first stage where it's like someone who doesn't know anything about climbing suddenly has this appreciation for what I'm doing. So I guess like that external validation has felt meaningful at times, but I also like try to caution myself and just be like, well, like they don't really know anything still about climbing. They're, you know, I appreciate that they're excited for me. But I think that, I think that just keeping it real with myself, so to speak, and like being proud of the things that I've done in the sport is like top priority. And then like, of course, like I'm happy that like family is happy for me and friends are happy for me. And it's like funny to like have like, you know, that one guy from high school like reach out and be like, whoa, like hey, like long time no talk, but really cool to see you progressing in your journey. Just to say that, like, I think that it has been definitely exciting, but I also think that maybe it's also a time when I recognize that I need to, you know, continue to focus on what I think is important in the sport and not let any one competition sort of define me. To your point, I think it's really hard to do that. I think, of course, I want a lot out of that experience, but I also think that, like, I've wanted a lot out of other competitions before. It hasn't gone my way and life has gone on. And for me, like, my priority is just being able to climb for most of my life and having it be a sport that has, like, longevity. And I'm just hopeful that I'm able to keep that up.
But I mean, were there tears? Like, was your mom and dad? I mean, I don't know if your mom and dad are around, like, but you know what your family consists of, but I mean, you know, like,
yeah, they're, yeah, definitely, I mean,
little
over the
Jesse's
moon,
in the
sure.
Olympics, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny, like, I called them and they were like I hadn't talked to them almost at all about, like, the qualifying process, like, right. I just, like, I mean, I had tried to explain it, but I was like, oh, like, yeah, and this will happen and that will happen, yada yada, like, probably not gonna happen, but just so you know. And then I, like, called them right after and they were like, we had no idea, like, you hadn't told us at all. And, like, I don't know, like, I had, but maybe I just hadn't, like, hyped it up too much. So I think, yeah, they were, of course, like, over the moon. And yeah, definitely tears on my end. Yeah, all around.
Last question, who's going to win gold?
That's a great question.
The answer is Jesse Gruber.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
That's the answer.
This is a softball, dog.
All right, I love it. This is an answer for Chris, not me. I'm going to try my darndest.
All right, there you go. You're such a sweet
really
kid.
Hard.
You're such a sweet kid, Jesse. Just like,
thanks.
Take it, own it. You're going to win.
I'm going to try my best.
Buster Jezik is a climber and certified AMGA guide from Estes Park, Colorado. He is also an accomplished rock drummer. On today's final bit, we feature Buster covering the drums of the esteemed Neil Peart on Rush's classic Tom Sawyer. Peart is the patron saint of most rock drummers, and matching his fills is like sending 13+. Buster at ColoradoMountainSchool.com is his contact for guiding, or follow him on his YouTube channel. Link in the show notes.
Just listen to another episode of the Run Out podcast. If you like our show, the best way to support us is by giving us money. We don't care about iTunes ratings. You can share it with your friends or don't, whatever. But we are 100% listener supported because we believe this is the best way to stay independent, say what we think, and be accountable to the most important people in our lives, which is you, our listeners. To support our show, check us out on Patreon. It's patreon.com/runoutpodcast. For as little as $5.14 a month, you can become part of the Runout Nation and get bonus episodes that will titillate your ear holes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.